Hi, I'm Jim Shear, host of 180 Degrees, a podcast brought to you by the Sustainable Energy Authority of Ireland. In this series, I talk to climate leaders about how they first connected to the urgent need for climate action. We go back to their roots and talk about their journeys, discover what drives them and what keeps them motivated. We also explore the essential ingredients required for leadership on climate action here in Ireland and how we might impact internationally. Nothing short of a societal movement is now needed to ensure a livable planet for our children and future generations. My guest today, Dr. Lorna Gold, is well known for her passion for climate justice and sustainable development. Originally from Scotland, Lorna moved to Ireland in 2002 and took up a role with TROCRA. During her time in TROCRA, she worked primarily in areas of applied research interest, including international cooperation, sustainable development goals, climate justice, and just transition. She is currently vice chair of the board of the Global Catholic Climate Movement, the movement set up to implement Pope Francis's teachings on the environment globally. Lorna is also author of Climate Generation, Awakening to Our Children's Future, which describes her own personal story of waking up to the ecological emergency as a mother, academic, and activist. We talk about faith-based approaches to dealing with the climate crisis and the huge potential to act faster when we act with a sense of compassion and togetherness.
Dr. Lorna Gold, thank you so much for joining us on the SEAI podcast.
Great to be here, Jim.
As we've done with other guests, I'd like to start by bringing you back in time a little bit and asking if you remember a moment when you first became interested in environmental issues.
I do, actually. And you have to take me way, way back to when I was a child and I was at secondary school. And I remember I was always into geography and I was doing a geography project about my local area. And in my local area, from where I live, you can see the Grangemouth oil refinery, or where I lived when I was growing up. You could see the Grangemouth oil refinery, which processed all the North Sea oil in Scotland. And I remember looking at that and wondering about the implications of oil and gas and fossil fuels. And often at night, the glow from the flares would wake us up, this orange glow in the sky. And when I did that project, I was age 12, so that's like taking you back a long time, I came across this theory called the greenhouse effect. And I still remember now doing that project and drawing the globe and drawing the greenhouse effect around it and making the connection to fossil fuels and to my local area. And I remember even at that time, sure that, well, they were talking about the early 2020s as the time that this would actually, the world would kind of wake up or we would see the impacts of climate change. And me thinking, God, I'll be an old woman then. I don't need to worry about the 2020s. But at the same time, I think that is what really sparked my interest in climate change. And to be honest, I never looked back. That was me fascinated by this topic and about sustainable development energy and wanted to work in that area.
When I first met you, was at a conference on climate action hosted by the Sisters of Mercy in Carrick-on-Shannon, and you presented and launched your book, The Climate Generation. Can you tell us a bit about how you got to that point from that young age of that young interest and what you were doing at that time, maybe a bit about the genesis of your book?
Yeah, I went from school to then I did a degree and PhD in geography. And all the way through my studies, the focus was really about there must be another way, there must be another economic system that we can, that's more sustainable, that can deliver better outcomes for people, for the environment. I studied at a university, but also got very involved in campaigning issues around around climate, around social justice issues. And between one thing and another, I ended up coming to Ireland in 2002 after completing my PhD to work for TROCRA. The reason I came to work for TROCRA was really because I was fascinated by the policy dimension of the question of climate change and sustainability. And I knew that faith organisations or development organisations had a big role to play in helping to change change policy. I spent then almost 20 years, just before lockdown, I moved on from Chokra, but absolutely loved the time working there. And it gave me such an insight into the policy dimensions, working to change the Irish government's policies, working to influence international policy on climate change, but also the importance of really engaging the grassroots. Like, you can't change the policies at a national or international level unless you have a groundswell of opinion or like people want it to change. So, I mean, when you met me in up in Carrick and Shannon at that conference, I'd really come through this kind of 20 years working, nearly 20 years working with Chokra. But I wanted to also kind of bring more a personal dimension to this story of climate change. And I think becoming a parent really impacted me, knowing the science, knowing the timelines that around this, a bit like Greta Thunberg says, like, the world's on fire. Like, we're in an emergency situation when it comes to climate emissions. And yet feeling that this is not, nobody sees it. Even now after COVID, I think we see it all around us. But there's still this kind of, I mean, academics call it cognitive dissonance, like a kind of this distance between what we know to be true and how we behave. So climate generation was the result, I think, of me working through becoming a parent, reconciling myself with the kind of anxiety that brings and the hope that you have for your kids. And trying to turn that into a story that other parents could relate to. And I think that's what climate generation was all about, is helping other parents to enter into this story in a hopeful way. Because whilst there's a lot of doom and gloom out there, I think as parents, we're almost bound to continue to have hope.
You've talked there about your science background, policy, also religion and faith and engaging people. So on the religion and faith side, has spirituality and religion, has that always been a strong theme in your life, as well as that science background that you have?
I would say so. I mean, I grew up in a Catholic family, and my mom was always a very practical, she still is, but she, when we were growing up, was not a kind of dogmatic, you could say, or kind of Catholic or kind of imposing something on us. She very much taught us in our own way, I would say, and to live according to our values and to believe in a loving presence, to believe in a loving God. And she always, interestingly now, because I would say I'm a great admirer of Pope Francis and all the work he's done on the environment. When I was growing up, my mom always told us the story of Saint Francis of Assisi. And it was one of the prayers that we used to say every day going out to school. So I guess that was ingrained in me from a very young age, that not in a kind of wear your faith on your sleeve kind of way, but this kind of deep-rooted belief in a loving presence and the need to engage with people on a deep level, on a deep spiritual level, in order to bring about change. And I think I've seen so much, especially now in the work I'm doing with an organisation called Faith Invest, which is working with faiths to move their assets, move their financial and non-financial assets to tackle the climate crisis, that faith and faith communities are a massive, powerful force in the world and can use that powerful force for good if they choose to do so. And it's a really interesting thing that we're doing with Faith Invest now, working across faiths, so that what you discover is that this belief in the need to care for the planet, to earth care for the planet, care for creation, it's not a Christian thing, or it's not only a Christian thing, it's something that extends across all religions. So even if you just do the simple math, that faith communities, people who adhere to a faith, are 84% of the world's population. Faith communities and faith organisations own or control around 16% of the land the livable landmass in the planet. If you count then, for example, in the Catholic Church, the 200,000 parishes across the world, you start to kind of say in your head, if all of these groups have this profound belief in care for the earth, then surely they are major stakeholders in what happens. And also you have to then say, well, they also must be a big part of the problem. If they're not living by those values, that's also an issue that needs to be addressed. So I think on two levels, I think there's the kind of personal spiritual level, which has always guided me. But also I kind of look and see strategically from a systems change point of view, we need to mobilise faith communities. And like they are one of the groups that I think is been not quite ignored, but it's an interesting debate to have around why are the faiths absent from or largely absent from this discussion.
This interface between science and faith and science communication. So I met with John Sweeney and we talked about getting the science across, and that sometimes really rocking people to the core and, you know, potentially, you know, causing anxiety, but also generating action and things like that. What do you see at the interface of science and faith and religion, and how those can come together, or can they?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And I think that modernity in general has seen these as kind of polar opposites. So the faith is seen as almost like, you could say, the fairy story. It's the thing that, the consolation, the thing that kind of gives you a little bit of solace in a material world. And the science looks at the material world and the kind of what we can know about that world. Even developments in science, in neuroscience, and all different branches of science have shown that these could be complementary areas of human experience. And I think the more you delve into the science, you uncover the sense of mystery. Great scientists would recognise the mystery at the heart of many of the discoveries. And then at the same time, religion, I think if it's, or I would say more faith, if it's taken, let's say, not in a kind of fundamentalist way, but is also open to other ways of being and other ways of thinking, can offer a great sense of meaning, a great sense of motivation for people to actually see that this world and it is worth saving and is worth engaging in. And I think to me those are complementary. And to me the master of this really is Pope Francis, in terms of this thinking around the relationship. And in his letter that he wrote in 2015, which really kind of blew open this whole area of faith and science, Laudato Si, on care for a common home, he calls for a dialogue involving all different sides of human experience. And that's something really profound. I think, obviously, popes generally pontificate, which is probably, we would consider, the opposite of calling for dialogue. But the whole of the mission of Pope Francis has been to kind of break open this whole area of dialogue.
Yeah, got it. And with your work with Faith Invest, you've actually recently met Pope Francis, and in terms of being in conversation, you were in a room with him and some others recently. Could you tell us about that experience and what the conversation is about? What's the latest on that conversation?
Yeah, I mean, I've been really privileged over the past few years to work quite closely with Pope Francis and some of the team at the Vatican, as well as working in Faith Invest. I'm the chair of the board of a Laudato Si movement, which specifically is looking at how to mobilise the Catholic Church around environmental issues. But the recent meeting with the Pope just last summer, we were meeting with Greg Asner and Robin Asner, well-known ecologists from Hawaii, with a chief from the Amazon, with a Muslim street kid, and with one of the climate campaigners from India, young climate strikers. And the purpose of the meeting was to sit round together with the Pope and to really ask ourselves, how can these different, vastly different experiences of life, but all that all share a common objective of caring for the planet and changing the way things are going, how can we work more together? And it was a very profound experience. Pope Francis talked, there's a parable in the Bible called the Tower of Babel, where they're trying to build this tower, but like there's a curse put on them where people can't speak to each other. And he was saying to us that in our quest for climate action and climate justice, between the scientists and the people of faith, the indigenous and the youth, that's what it can often feel like, that we're all just talking in our own bubbles, in our own language, and there's no real collaboration and listening. And I think that's what really characterised the meeting that we had with the Pope, which incidentally will come out as a feature documentary later in the year.
Excellent.
That this need for listening, this need for really listening to each other and not trying to kind of say, oh, well, the way we do it's the right way. We've got all the answers. And then the people on the other side are like, well, no, we do it. Everybody has a valid viewpoint, and we can all come around a table to recognise that we're much stronger if we work together and if we form. And in my mind, it's the only thing that's going to change things now, is this a sense that we can come together as a mass movement, as a movement that enables us to respect diversity, but to come together to work for climate action and climate justice.
It sounds like a really big conversation, like it's about a global coming together and a global movement. Does it translate well down to a national level here in Ireland? I mean, we have the National Dialogue on Climate Action kicking off again this year. Do you see any parallels, or what could we bring from that and learn for how we approach it here in Ireland?
Yeah, I think there's lots that can be done here. I think there's been many strides forward with climate action in the past 10 years in Ireland. It's when you look back to, I mean, for me, when I was working with Trocra and we were doing all the work around fossil fuel divestment, and then work around the first round of the climate assembly. When you look at where things are now, whilst we have a long way to go in terms of meeting targets and meeting them really, like especially the sectoral targets and how you actually operationalize those, we've made leaps and bounds forward. And I think the consciousness that there is now in the general public around climate change is really evident. But I think that this question to me of how do you engage faith and the kind of the faith communities and different sectors of society is one that perhaps we've not really taken on board yet. There is amazing work happening within the faith communities. Just last 2 weeks ago, I was involved with Faith Invest in a meeting in Antarshuk Ecological Centre, run by the Dominican Sisters in Wicklow. An amazing little place. People can look it up. It offers conferences. It offers sabbaticals for people to go and have, like, learn about eco-spirituality. But we had a meeting there of representatives of around 50 religious orders. And I know there's other conversations in Ireland that are really difficult about history and about the legacy, and nobody is denying that that's an important conversation. But these were religious orders that were looking at how they can use the assets that they have and the legacy that they have and all the kind of heritage that's in a lot of the wonderful work that the religious orders have done over the years, how they can now put that to the service of climate action. And I mean, some of the things they're doing in Ireland, another example I love, many of them are involved in the Eco Congregations Network, which is an ecumenical network which supports faith organisations in Ireland and in the UK to be sustainable, more sustainable. So it's very practical stuff around how do you put make energy efficiency savings, how do you put solar panels on, retrofitting. I'm sure they've been in touch with SEAI. And other things like biodiversity, how do you, the church grounds are an amazing resource for biodiversity. How do you green your investments, those kind of things. But Ireland really is leading the way in many respects, but it's very silent in terms of the national conversation. There's nothing about this in the news. There's nothing about this kind of, even in the climate dialogues, I would say, where does the whole heritage of the Celtic spiritualities, the deep kind of spiritual heritage of Ireland fit in with the modern national conversation on these issues?
Yeah, I think it's a really good point. And you talk about these meetings and these gatherings as being the movement. And, you know, couldn't agree more. These communities that are coming together are the movement, are the people who are. And so what else could you share about the story of that day that, you know, sort of illustrates where we might bring that in terms of expanding it here in Ireland?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think that day in the morning, for example, we had conversations with different religious orders, and we talked about some of the different projects that they are already doing. So the Kiltegans, the St. Patrick's Missionary Society, for example, in Kiltegan, are engaged with a project called the 1 Acre Project, where they have converted to renewable energy source, and they have a willow. It's called the Willow Project, so they have a willow farm, but they're also facing kind of practical obstacles. One of the things that we find is that some of these religious there's particular issues and concerns around the places of worship, for example. They're community buildings. They're not residencies, but they're not public buildings. So there's heritage issues around them. So we were discussing that issues around, well, who do you go to? Where do you get the support? And would there be a place, for example, for a particular kind of program that targeted faith communities? Because faith communities are more than NGOs. They're not an NGO in the same sense as a Chokra or another organization. They're a vast network of communities that have physical assets, have financial assets, but also have this kind of intangible assets of influence in the community, but also networks in local communities. So that was one of the conversations was, well, would there be a place and where would you go for additional support on practical issues? For example, the planning obstacles that people face, like even if they want to put up solar panels. Basically, what people were saying is we can do a lot more and we want to do a lot more. And we can do a lot more on our land. We can do a lot more with our buildings. But there seem to be some obstacles in the way and we don't really know who to go to. So that was one of the, I think, having a way to figure that out, but also making it a more, opening up the conversation also at a deeper level of what is the role of faith communities in this conversation in Ireland today? And is there a place for people of faith to come together around climate change?
Seems like that's what you're creating. Where would people start if they're listening now? I mean, what's the best place for if people hear something in this thread? I mean, it's very positive movement. How could they join? I mean,
I think they can contact Faith Invest. That's contact me, and I'll make my details available to anybody who wants to get involved from a Faith Invest site, or go onto the website faithinvest.org. to find out about what is happening. There's a whole page there which is about putting Laudato Si into action. And I know that if people are in Ireland, there's multi-faith communities, but the majority are from the Christian world. And I know that Laudato Si really speaks to a lot of the Christian, not just Catholic, but Christian communities. So there's a lot on our Laudato Si webpage on Faith Invest. If you're looking for something Ireland based, I would suggest going to Eco Congregations Ireland and contacting them, because they have a program for faith communities, which means that you can enroll and you can get support to make your community more sustainable.
Excellent. You talked about the 60, was it 16% of is it the global landmass is overseen by different religions and faith organizations? Do you have some more figures? Do you have some figures for Ireland and then some other figures globally? What's the scale of the potential here for these movements on their own land, I guess, to start with?
Yeah, I don't have any more detailed figures than that. That figure is from a book called The World Atlas of Religions, which is in itself is a little bit dated. I think the last edition is 10 years old, and it would be an amazing project for somebody to do to update that, looking at the resources of the faiths. But I think that the projects that we're working with other faith communities have really shown that where land is owned or controlled by faith groups, there's almost like a kind of an effect around it where land is deemed to be sacred. And the way that kind of protects forests, this is a particular phenomenon in Southeast Asia, around Buddhist temples, where they can see that the land around a temple is deemed to be sacred. And Buddhist monks, in some places, even have rituals to consecrate the trees, which means that tree can never be cut down. But in other faith traditions or kind of other belief systems that are really strong still in different parts of the world, that there is really a sense of respect for nature and for the protection of the forests. We're involved with Faith Invest in promoting a major initiative called Sacred Forests, which has been set up by a group called EcoSeek. So each of the faiths now have these kind of ecological arms attached to them. So there's Eco-Islam, there's EcoSeek, there's Laudato Si in the Catholic world, and similar for other faiths. But EcoSeek have really ambitious plans for tree growing and reforesting. So to plant sacred forests all over the world. And they have just planted their first sacred forest in Ireland, which I think is wonderful. There's a very small Sikh community in Ireland. But if people go onto EcoSeek website, they'll be able to find the details of the sacred forest in Ireland.
Excellent. And I was just thinking about, like, growing up myself, and I went to a Catholic school, but I stopped practicing any formal religion. But I'd say, I consider myself, say, spiritual on some level. What do you say to people who aren't involved in an organized faith, and how can they get involved, or what role or what connections do you see there?
Well, firstly, it's about finding your kind of tribe. I think that's the first thing I've found, that in the climate movement and in the kind of generally in life, I find that you need to find your tribe at a deep level, and whether that's through organized religion or whether that's through other practices, yoga or other kind of spiritual practices that help you to connect with yourself, whether it's in a mindful way, a spiritual way, but that I think everybody recognises there's that deeper level of human experience, human consciousness, that some of us find that an organised community, such as a parish or a church or a movement, is the way to do that. Others, it's a more personalised individual. But still finding that way to connect with others who share that is really, really helpful. And then joining with others. I love now the work that I do in terms of the diversity. It's not that I'm meeting a Sikh and trying to convert them to Catholicism, or a Hindu and trying to make them more Catholic or something. It's about really recognizing the richness and diversity. And if we can agree that we want to work together to save our beautiful planet, that's something we can all agree on, because there isn't a Catholic planet and a Hindu one and a Muslim one. There's one planet. And a bit of humility as well, I think, goes a long way with people of faith, with faith communities. We need to not be dogmatic, I think, about our faith beliefs. Have a bit of humility and a bit of questioning whilst recognising the value of each other's traditions.
Yeah, it's great what you said. I think we're definitely better together.
Absolutely.
You talked about intergenerational issues as well. You mentioned your kids and as part of the inspiration for the book. And we met at the climate strikes in Dublin right back when they started. And we've seen a massive youth movement globally and here in Ireland over recent years. And young people are really crying out for older generations to get our act together. How do you feel when you hear calls like these?
It breaks my heart, to be honest. It really does. I was at the climate strike in Stockholm. I was at the United Nations Stockholm Plus 50 conference 2 weeks ago. And there was a lot of hot air, I have to say, at the conference. It was quite depressing to see how little has changed in 50 years. And then on the Friday, I went to the Stockholm climate march, climate strike, as Greta Thunberg does every week still, but there were about 5,000 of us there on that particular Friday. And I mean, there's the heartache, especially when I see young children at these marches, as I did in Glasgow last year at the COP or in Stockholm. I just kind of, it grabs something inside me. And I think, why are we not just as grown-ups really taking this bull by the horns and doing everything that we can? And I think the heartache for me comes from the knowing how little time we have to turn this around and seeing the effects of global warming everywhere now. And so it's that kind of, if we had all the time in the world, I would feel inspired. But it was my generation that were marching 30 years ago. And still, here we are, another generation that are marching and calling the older generation out. So there's that heartache. But then listening to these young people and listening to the climate activists, you can't but be inspired by the sheer clarity of their thought. Someone said to me in Stockholm, young people see really clearly because they haven't kind of bought into the system yet. They don't have all the trappings of the mortgage and the car and the good job and everything. They've got nothing to lose, really. So they have this real laser sharp clarity on what is happening, what is wrong.
Yeah. So the older generation's complicating things. I mean, on some level, it is simple. I mean, we have to stop using fossil fuels and do something about the food system, and are we getting in our own way?
I mean if you think, like, what frustrates me, I was thinking about what frustrates me in the climate kind of the struggle for climate justice. I think that the biggest frustration now for me is the kind of lack of government action on climate change and up to the level that we need. Like, we saw in the COVID crisis that governments can act. Gosh, they could act. They could take away your personal freedoms if they need to for a health emergency. But there isn't the same set kind of resolve. And I think, in fact, after COVID, there's a lot of fragmentation and a lot of competing kind of concerns. I'm not talking just about Ireland, but internationally. And now, obviously, the whole war and conflict in Ukraine. There's a lot of frustration that government is not acting on the science and acting with the requisite kind of urgency, especially given now that many, many of the solutions are there. I mean, this is really what angers me. We have the solutions. We have the technologies. We have what we need. If it was rapidly scaled up and taken with the level of seriousness that we took COVID, like, we can scale things up, we can do things, we can act together. But you can't do that when another kind of whole part of the mechanism, or let's say the system, is undermining. I almost see it as like the SEAIs are doing this amazing work to bring sustainable energy communities, to retrofit, to, it's all amazing work. But then when there's fossil fuel subsidies and there's kind of a return to looking at fracked gas, and there's talk of oil exploration. You can't do both at the same time. They counter each other out, and it sends mixed messages. Last year, faith leaders from all over all the different faiths signed a quite remarkable statement together before the COP, which got virtually unnoticed by most of the world. But I was part of a small group involved in that. And this, like, faith leaders often sign statements which have a lot of platitudes in them, saying governments need to do this and you need to change. But this statement was different. It said all the kind of what's wrong. And then the second half of it said, and we as faiths are now going to create bold plans for sustainability throughout the world. And we're going to align our investments to climate solutions. So to me, as we said right at the start, the fact that this is a bit of an untapped resource for in terms of the deep values and commitment that many people have. Can you imagine if every imam and priest and rabbi stood up on their holy day and preached for climate justice and preached for the end of fossil fuels and then said, and we've taken all our investments out of fossil fuel companies and we're putting solar panels on the roof and we're putting a wind turbine in. And, you know, it's the scalability of that is really huge.
Yeah. So it's calling for something, but it's also taking action. I mean, you talked about a lot of the emotions that I think many people listening have maybe felt at one time or another, between frustration and anger and even fear at the science, or anxiety about what's going on. And you sound massively motivated for your work. How do you stay in that place and in a world of activity, or how do you deal with those emotions when they come up for you and keep going on this mission?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that faith can be really good for that as well. That one of the things about, let's say, a spiritual community is having a space to acknowledge the grief and the pain. Where do we turn in times of grief? Even if people are not religious, they turn to the church generally. And I think that faith communities can be really part of a transformative kind of moment through offering spaces, and many churches are doing this, even in Ireland, and creating welcoming spaces for people to come and kind of acknowledge the way the world is and grieve for the passing of the species. And it's because we are in a moment of grief in society for the world that perhaps we would have dreamt of, in terms of, especially I feel in terms of biodiversity. It's the thing that really strikes me. And we need to acknowledge that. We can't deny it. And I think that spirituality can really help with that, but it can also help us to move forward.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like what you're saying is it's very important, first of all, just to face the truth or the state of play where we're at now.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that you have to do that in order to kind of move forward. It's hard to stay in that place sometimes, because it can be, I think that there is a real wave coming now of, somebody called it climate doomism. And I think that when that seeps into the public, it can be really dangerous, because people think, well, what's the point? What's the point of doing anything? But there's a balance between facing up to the truth of the situation and not falling into doomism. And I really take a lot from Greta Thunberg. And she's not just Greta Thunberg, but the whole idea of active hope, Joanna Macy's idea of active hope. And I love, she's got lots of books about how do you kind of move out of that place of like kind of paralysis into hope. And the idea of active hope is that hope's a doing word. It's not a feeling. I might feel like less optimistic some days or more optimistic others, but hope is something that we build. And that, like on the Fridays going to the climate strikes, or whenever I engage in a conversation to build the movement, I come away from that feeling more hopeful. because hope is something that we create and we build together. So that idea, the act of hope, and Greta Thunberg said, hope comes when we act and only then. Sitting at home, doing nothing, feeling depressed about the situation is a spiral. It only leads to more disempowerment and doom. But even thinking about one thing you can do each day, one thing that is an action that builds movement, that builds hope, I find great kind of energy when I'm able to say to myself, but hope is a verb, hope's an active word.
Excellent. Finally, Lorna, as we've done with other guests, we're asking you now to look to the future, and this is a kind of an imagination piece in a way. Maybe it's a storytelling piece, I'm not sure, but when you think about the future, say in 2050, what do you see for Ireland and globally in terms of, you know, how have we gone in addressing this climate and biodiversity crisis?
I think that people will look back and will see that there was a moment where people realised that the way things were going couldn't continue. And they started to make changes that in their personal lives, in their communities, and also putting pressure for government to make change. But they realised that they couldn't just sit back and let other people make the changes. They had to make the changes themselves. And that from my point of view, I think that I can see that the faith communities played a really big role in that, looking back. That there was a wake-up call from Pope Francis, from Patriarch Bartholomew, from many different faith leaders who said, we need to act urgently to change the way things are going. And they called on their followers to do that. But they didn't do it alone. They joined forces with others and with people with no faith at all, with the scientists, because they believed in the science, which was the ironic thing people thought at the time. Here's the faith leaders believing in the science and calling us to change. But that, to me, was the pivotal moment where things started to change and people started to wake up. And I think in 2050... I don't know if I'll be around. Maybe I will, with my great-grandchildren. Hopefully we'll be sitting on the other side of a major crisis and we'll say, wasn't it amazing how people came together and took action?
I hope you're right. Lorna, thank you so much for your time today and for all your work and sharing your experience with us. Really appreciate it. And thanks for the conversation.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. We hope you enjoyed our conversation and it's left you in action and hopeful for our future. Please visit seai.ie/podcast for information on each of our guests this season and links to further relevant material to support you around your own climate actions or resources if you are suffering from any climate anxiety. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to 180 Degrees and rate the podcast to help us spread the word.